you're, you know stuff about sports and all the different kinds of like categories of things and everything. You're like me. We're like Renaissance men, except I have never understood that term because it's like if we were in the Renaissance, we'd be very different than we are now.
Oh no, I'd be dead.
100%. I'd be supreme. Oh, I'd probably be dead, but I'd definitely be, if I were alive, I'd be like the peasantiest peasant who ever peasanted.
Oh yeah. I would have gotten recruited to be a pikeman for some random foray into some bullshit, and I would have died because I'm clumsy as hell. So I'd been like, ah, and I'm just, or starvation. Starvation, one of the two, you know.
Starvation would have been a good one, yeah. Or just, dysentery.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Or velociraptors or whatever they had like in the Renaissance. Welcome to episode number 83 of the Memory Jar. As always, we are here to remember the cards, the decks, the people, and the stories that make Magic the game we love. I'm David Prestwood, and with me, as always, is my co-host Christian Wright. Christian, how are you doing this week?
I am stuffed. I cannot move. I ate too much at a Friendsgiving yesterday, and now I'm being rolled around by my partner because I cannot walk. I am just a bulbous, mass. Like, the blueberry girl in Willy Wonka the Chocolate Factory? That's me.
Yeah.
That's just,
okay.
You just push me over, yeah.
I've always thought of Friendsgiving as like an actual Thanksgiving, but with friends, like on Thanksgiving. Are you telling me you had a Thanksgiving meal 3 weeks early just for lols?
You haven't? Why do you hate feasts? Especially when the weather yesterday in D.C. outside it was 79 degrees. It was a perfect, blustery, autumnal day. Autumnal. Whatever. I'll mispronounce however I feel like.
79 degrees at DC in November is just like wildly inappropriate.
You're telling me. And we had just come from a place that should have been at 79 degrees, but it wasn't. So it's even more ironic.
That's true. We have just come back from Magic 30 in Las Vegas, where the weather was actually beautiful day and night. And we are going to share the interviews that we took there. We asked people about their favorite card from Magic's first year. And if they remember the first booster they opened. But before we get to that, like we always do, let's crack open the memory jar. All right, this is a great one. This is Crunch Wrangler. This is a common from War of the Spark. It's one in the green for a 2/1 human warrior with trample. And it says, whenever a creature with power 4 or greater enters the battlefield under your control, put a +1/+1 counter on Crunch Wrangler. This is like more recent than most of our random cards, but given how many cards are produced these days, we were due. Scryfall tells me that there are 2,231 cards that got their first printing in the year 2022, which is more than first printed cards in Alpha, Beta, Unlimited, Arabian Nights, Antiquities, Legends, The Darkfallen Empires, Ice Age, Chronicles, Homelands, Alliances, Mirage, Visions, Portal, and all these sort of promos that were printed before Weatherlight. So, the first like 4 years of Magic. Okay. So Crunch Wrangler is a great name.
Yeah. Crunch Wrangler is a great name. For the record, I started when Weatherlight was the most recent set. And I read books that had all the Magic encyclopedias that had all these cards. And that's wild that they could do a Magic encyclopedia with the same content of all the cards released this year. But anyway, wow. Crunch Wrangler is a fantastic name.
It's a great name. It's just fun to say. I just have a Crunch question. So yes. The only other Crunch card we know of is Raging Crunch, which is a beast, also for More of the Spark. There are, to my knowledge, no crunches, even in the art of any other cards. So where did the crunches come from? Were the Gruul just like hiding them for some reason?
Yeah, they're hiding them with their butts.
With their butts?
With up their butts, not with their butts.
Wow.
Up their butts. Yeah.
Okay. No. So what, they just let them out when all the Planeswalkers started a fight?
Yeah, they're so ornery and they're just like, we have to deploy our secret weapon, the crunches that are up our butts.
Yeah,
this
I guess
is a very mature conversation on the podcast.
Wow, we've really done it. Vegas has apparently destroyed our brains. But well, for 9 Ravnica sets, and then the final one was the only one where we saw any crunches. We've only had 2. Maybe if we go back, we'll see some more. I remember playing this card in Limited. If I recall correctly, it was mostly fine because of synergy with Bloom Hulk, which was a common that was 3 and a green for a 4/4 plant elemental, and it had when it entered the battlefield proliferate, and so you could play this, you play that 2 turns later, this gets a counter, you proliferate the counter, and then you've got like a 4/4 to 4/3, and that was pretty cool. The only problem with this was you had to get at least one counter, because there were amass tokens in this set, all these 1/1 zombie army tokens. Well, they started as 1/1s that could grow, but players are just willing to throw them away. They're totally expendable. And so one of those could block this. Mm-hmm. And so you had to get that counter.
Yeah, I don't think I ever played it, but that's because there was just so much other stuff going on in the set that, like, I never went deep with it on green. Or, like, I just didn't open it in my sealed packs. But, yeah, I mean, you had things like Evolution Sage 2 that could grow it. You had plenty of ways for the creatures to get bigger so that, you know, they'd be 4 power when they entered the battlefield. But, yeah, there actually also wasn't a whole lot of 4 power cards in green itself. Like, besides the Bloom Hulk, there's Wardscope Crocodile, which is 4 and a green for a 5/3 hexproof creature. And then Thundering Ceratoc, which is 4 and a green for a 4/5 rhino with trample. And also Primordial Worm, but no one played Primordial Worm, so we won't talk about that. In general, you had to, like, work for it a little bit, but it did work well when you worked.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, black, I recall, being the best color in War of the Spark because a lot of the removal spells were there. And so if you got Tithebreaker Giant, the 6-mana 4/5 that was basically the same as many of these Phyrexian cards, you know, it enters the battlefield, you lose a life and draw a card. That was another nice thing with this. But you were playing it so late, so I feel like you really needed to have the green cards. Or if you were in Gruul, you had Turret Ogre in red, which is the 4/3 reach for 4. And so those cards really helped you make Crunch Wrangler. Good. And you could wrangle some crunches.
Yeah. Out of your butt. Who knew?
I'm not Gruul. That's not it.
I'm neither. All right. So.
Well, on to the main topic. Christian, why don't you introduce what we're talking about today?
Yeah. So as you mentioned at the top of the show, we were at Magic 30 anniversary in Vegas last weekend. We're recording this on November 6th, 2002. And we had a blast. We both went, we did side events. And most importantly, we talked to a lot of people we have not talked to or seen since before the pandemic. And so for this special episode, we decided let's do a throwback to 30 years of Magic. Let's ask people what their favorite card from the first year of Magic is. So those sets include Alpha, Beta, Unlimited. We had Antiquities. We had Arabian Nights. We had Legends and the Dark, and we want to ask them what their favorite card from that first year was out of those sets, and also what was the first booster they opened. Kind of like a nice little question of how did you get this journey started.
It seems like this is in the wheelhouse of our podcast, and Magic 30 was just an encapsulation of everything that we do. And so we'll kick off our first interview with a multiple time guest of the podcast who Christian had met, but I had never met in person, and I was jumping up and down with joy. So let's kick it off. All right. So we're here at Magic 30 with fan favorite, frequent podcast guest, David Lifer Tilly, who you may know from the Magic Bracket and other things. He's judging.
Woo, woo. Hey, I sure am. I am manning the command zone right now. We're getting people in. It's actually nice and busy today. It was a little quiet yesterday, but it's really jamming today. Having a good time, welcoming people, getting some fun magic happening.
I don't need that.
That's fine. So who have you judged the most?
Well, to be honest, I've mostly been judging some really interesting cosplayers as they walk past and, like, seeing some cool costumes. There was, like, a baby cosplayer.
Oh, I saw that.
So cute. Oh, my God.
It was, like, Jace, right?
Yeah, yeah, with, like, wings and Mummy was playing Nahiri. And real cute, but, like, every second that any kind of thing, distraction was happening, baby was grabbing mother's mask, tearing it to pieces and throwing it on the floor. So that wasn't so great, but other than that, like, really, really stinking cute. It's just been nice. Like, there's been lots of magic faces and people that I recognize and cool stuff happening. I've had to just wander around watching some commander and, like, seeing people's sweet cards and altars and, like, some of these, like, small playmats that people make now that you can put in the middle of your 4 playmats for, like, keeping, which has, like, spots for command damage and, like, how many times you've cast your commander and a space for your commander and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's a sweet innovation. Some cool ideas. So. Yeah, it's been really cool.
Well, that sounds super sweet, but we're here to ask the important questions. Mainly, what's your favorite card from the first year of Magic? So 1993 through 1994.
Ooh. Through the Dark, specifically.
Well, it's actually Fallen Empires is legal.
I mean, I can shortcut for you. It's not going to be from Fallen Empires.
Well,
it's not going to be the tiebreaker of whether Fallen Empires makes it into the under the line or not. So I'm going to give you an answer based on what I'm currently been thinking about, which is I've been thinking a lot about camouflage from Alpha. Mm-hmm. And that's because one of the things I'm doing at this event tomorrow is that I am running the beta Rochester draft that they are doing.
Oh, so celebrity judge Beta Rodraster. Woo!
And one of the things I've had to do for that is try to remember the oracle text of every card in Beta, which is like 70% iconic / simple cards, 20% slightly weird cards, and 10% complete nonsense.
10% complete nonsense that did not show up in Revised for a reason.
Yes. And there's a lot of cards where... So there are some cards in Beta where they take way longer in the Oracle text, like the printed text, to explain than is strictly necessary. And the Oracle text is very simple now because we have better terminology and we don't have to explain how paying life for things works. And there are a lot, some cards where the printed text is just like a sort of hand-wavy description of what they want to happen, and the oracle text is five paragraphs of trying to make that work. And Camouflage is the one that's taken me the longest to get my head around it. The printed text is your attackers just all flip face down and your opponent has to block them without knowing what they are. And the kind of bending over backwards that Oracle has to do to make that work is pretty impressive. It involves piles. Two-headed giant of four eyes is allowed to be in multiple piles. It is an absolute disaster class. I'm hoping the card is unplayable so nobody needs to know the rules text, but this is also Beta draft, so you have to stretch pretty far on playables. There are lots of bad cards and like four basics in every booster, so you really have to play what you can.
Well, let me just say, I hope for your sake no one opens an Illusionary Mask.
Yeah, that's another one that I just don't want to have to deal with people remembering how much and what kind of mana they paid into that thing and all that stuff. Just do not want to deal with it.
All right, one more question we're asking this weekend. Do you remember the first pack of Magic cards you opened, either the set or even if you have specifics?
I can do you the exact pack. I'd learned to play from a friend and played a few games with his cards. The very first pack of cards I bought on my own were Prophecy. My rare was Avatar of Woe. I was incredibly excited about it being, I was like 15 years old. I could not imagine a better Magic card because it was a 2-mana 6/5 that killed all your opponent's creatures. I was just assumed it was 2-mana because it could be and therefore it should be. The art is so iconic. I mean, I can see RK Post's art stand from where I'm standing and that totally hooked me in, though I never looked back from there. So
that's amazing.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you, David Lightfortilli. Great to see you.
Great to see you, too.
Yes.
All right, so this is one where I absolutely have to read the original text, as Christian has reminded me. Camouflage is an uncommon, originally from Alpha, single green mana for an instant. You may rearrange your attacking creatures and place them face down, revealing which is which only after defense is chosen. If this results in impossible blocks, such as non-flying creatures blocking flying creatures, illegal blockers cannot block this turn. Impossible blocks is just a great phrase.
They should keep that. Impossible blocks. That's impossible. The current errata for this is kind of weird, so I'll read that. It's one, so Camouflage, one green for innocent. Cast a spell only during your declare attacker step. This turn, instead of declaring blockers, each defending player chooses any number of creatures they control, divides them into a number of piles equal to the number of attacking creatures for whom that player is the defending player. Creatures those players control that can block additional creatures may likewise be put into additional piles. Assign each pile to a different one of these attacking creatures at random. Each creature in a pile that can block the creature that pile is assigned to does so. Parentheses, piles can be empty.
Yeah, that's a nice parenthetical. Piles can be empty.
So how do you play with this card?
Number one, you don't. Unless you have the 30th anniversary edition Magic, which, by the way, does have the correct Oracle text on it.
Ooh. Nice.
So basically, you just don't declare blockers, and then you go back in time and you take this card out of your deck.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I have no idea how to work with this card, even with the current text. I'd just be like, okay, cool. You fog. You dealt it. You killed me. Like, awesome.
It's a fog. We did it. Something happened.
Something happened.
I did follow up with David after the Beta Rochester draft and ask him, wait, did someone end up opening Camouflage? And they did. And he got to do his rule spiel about Camouflage in the Oracle text. So.
Did that derail the draft? That'd been hilarious.
He said that the way it ended up working is they would open the pack, show the cards one by one, set them down in Rochester draft format, and then there'd be like a 5-minute Oracle text explanation, and then they'd give them like 30 seconds, and then they would actually draft.
That is, you know, how every draft should be done, to have a judge there to tell you this is how the rules actually work, because especially as Magic gets older and we'll play Magic into our retirement home age, it'll be good to get that memory of just like, what does that do? And they're like, well, proliferate increases the counters on people. And you're like, oh yeah, that's right. I don't remember my grandson's name, but I remember proliferate.
Unsurprising.
Unsurprising. Well, why don't we go to our next interview, which is actually a twofer.
That's the easy one.
So I'm here with Alistair and Shelley. It looks like we're about to play some EDH here, which is super fun. I see a inevitable betrayal, so this is going to be a fun deck. But Alistair, let's start with you. What is your favorite card from 1993 through 1994?
I would say the Abyss is hands down my favorite card in old school.
So why?
I bought one years ago before it spiked, and it's pretty impressive. If you're not familiar, each player at the beginning of their upkeep has to destroy a non-artifact creature of their choice. So what you do is you play a control deck with only artifact creatures, and your opponents can't keep creatures on the battlefield.
That's sweet. Yeah, I love the Abyss from back in the day. And it has that cool art where they're like, phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah, phenomenal.
Awesome. Well, okay, so Shelley, what about you?
Library of Alexandria.
Oh, that's a classic one. Why a library?
Card advantage.
Oh, yeah. You just always have seven cards. Have you played one in real life?
Yes.
That's
yeah.
Amazing. So I'll share a little tidbit too. I finally got to play one in real life, even though I've been playing Magic since 97. At a Power Cube, and it was one of those things. I picked it up and I was like, well, this is the only time in my life I remember to do this, so I'm taking advantage.
Well, I got a great deal on one years ago before I really even knew what it was.
Do you want to tell
that
story?
And then it went up in value, and that was just great. And yeah. Remember, you guys got... So,
specifically what happened, we were at a GP, and she asked me to buy two cards for $500 or under each that okay. I thought would appreciate in value. And she had me, I ended up buying a library and a Bazaar of Baghdad.
Woo!
And we sold the Bazaar because of the jump, yeah. Which was a big mistake in retrospect. But we held on to the library, which is cool to have.
That's awesome. Oh, then lastly, do you remember the first product you guys opened?
M13.
Oh, it was after that for me.
Theros.
Okay, so do you remember what was in the pack at all, or the product?
Product that we first purchased?
Yeah, so like I remember my first, I versus a 5th edition starter pack and I had a nightmare. And I thought that was cool. I love the art, like, you know, the galloping old nightmare. So I was just, I don't know if you remember anything from it or...
I just remember that I was looking to build a deck that was inexpensive and not too complicated. and so I was building a Merfolk, modern Merfolk deck.
Oh, yeah.
And then I stuck with it over the years and pimped it out and learned how to play. But that's what I remember about
it. That's awesome. What about you?
Archangel of Thune. That's the first card I remember opening that was half decent.
Oh, there you go. That's awesome. Well, thanks all. Really appreciate it.
Good talking to you.
Yeah. Hope you have a great day. So.
All right. Well, let's start with Alistair's card, the Abyss. The Abyss is 3 in a black for a world enchantment. Whoa! At the beginning of each player's upkeep, destroy target non-artifact creature that player controls of their choice. It can't be regenerated. Pretty simple. Pretty straightforward. Screw creatures. We all hate creatures.
Yeah, although you can't have this in play at the same time as Tombstone Stairwell, so I'm kind of out on it.
Yeah.
Only one world enchantment at a time. This is really cool. It only really comes up now when you hear players refer to having chump block a giant creature every turn, like throw a small creature in front of something big to protect their life total as the Abyss, because it basically has the same thing. You're just like destroying a creature of your choice every turn. For example, at Magic 30, I did the Halloween sealed event, which was a 7-pack sealed, 1-pack from each Innistrad set. And one of the cards I got to play was Lingering Souls. Classic Lingering Souls. That's, for anyone who doesn't know, it's an uncommon from Dark Ascension. It's 2 and a white for a sorcery, and you put 2/1/1 white spirit creature tokens with flying onto the battlefield. And then it has flashback for 1 and a black. So you can get 4/1/1 white spirit creature tokens. And I got to do this and flash it back to have 4 spirits to block their giant flyer and buy myself enough time to like draw actual good spells to win. In that case, the spell was Burn from Within, which is like X and a red, deal X damage to any target, and I just got them for 11. So, you know, that's what you do.
Must be nice. Must be nice. But yeah, so that's been the, you know, the fact, or if like you're in a game, in your situation where you're like just peeling off creatures in general, it's like, yeah, this creature is an Abyss. Oh, it's a 9/8. It'll keep killing creatures every turn, right?
Yes.
It's interesting that, so it's reserve listed, obviously. They've only had one printing of the Abyss ever, and that was Legends. They've tried putting this on creatures, but it didn't really take off. You have Magus of the Abyss, which is, you know, from the Magus cycle from Time Spiral Block, where it was the Abyss on a creature. Yeah, Magus of the Abyss was 3 in a black for 4/3. So, you know, it's Abyss on a stick, essentially. And then Reaper from the Abyss, which is from the original Innistrad set, had Morbid at the beginning of each end step. If a creature died this turn, destroy target non-demon creature. So it was Abyss on a stick that didn't affect demons. So they've tried it. It hasn't really taken off, but I'd love to see it if they could do a version of the Abyss. Maybe it has non-black creatures, so black, you know, to do a little bit of a twist on the Abyss itself. And you can get a, you know, nice reprint maybe at 3 black-black or something. Or not a reprint, but a version of it at 3 black-black. I think it'd be interesting.
One interesting note on the Abyss. Note that it is, you destroy target non-artifact creature. It's not that they sacrifice the non-artifact creature. People act like it's the same effect. It's not quite the same. So if you, which would be good, or your opponent, which would be bad, has an indestructible creature, that's what you choose. And then it's destroyed, but it doesn't actually go anywhere because it's indestructible. So if your opponent has that, you will be sad. Don't play the Abyss at that point.
Yeah, in general, this affects actually a ton of creatures. Like, white has a whole thing where creatures are gained indestructible, so you can certainly do that in response. Some creatures natively have it. Like, there's a couple of oozes that are just naturally indestructible. So in general, yeah, it's a nice little trick you can pull. So yeah, David, let's talk about Library of Alexandria.
Yeah, Library of Alexandria, my God. I mean, any card that's banned in every format except Vintage, where it's restricted, is totally fine by me. As you said, this is just one of those, it's kind of puts you at awe.
It's just one of those that would be part of a Power 10, people have said forever, if there was such thing as a Power 10. Now I think they would include maybe Time Vault instead of that, but it was on that list for a while. And yeah, it's just amazing to play in person. As I said on briefly in the interview, I got to play this in a cube, Power Cube, which was fantastic. And seeing it and actually seeing the entire text and tapping it to actually draw cards, like one of the best Magic experiences I've ever had. So,
well, next time you come over and we cube, I'll just throw my library in a cube and you'll have the opportunity. Just in like the Tubert, we'll just throw Library of Alexandria in the Tubert.
I'm sure that's balanced. So, all right, let's go to our next interview. It's a nice little nostalgia play we have here.
All right, David here at Magic 30. I've met Ron, who is a friend of my first round opponent. And Ron, what is your favorite card from Magic's first year?
I'm going to go with Leviathan.
Sick.
Just because it wasn't great when it first came out, but it got a lot better when Ice Age came out because you had that imp that could untap it. So you had like a 10-10. And my favorite deck back then, like way back when, was a bunch of pingers. And so I could just ping somebody down and have Leviathan just sit there and nobody could get through it. It was great.
I love that because that was like the hot card from the dark when it came out and nobody really knew how to use it. They just knew they wanted it. So it's nice to hear you had a plan and actually got it done.
Yeah, and like with all the other stuff that was around then, stuff like Royal Assassin, Sorcerer's Queen, I could just make something in O2 and kill it, have the Leviathan sit there, and once the way was clear, it was just like I ping you down and then just 10-10 coming right at you.
Phenomenal. Do you remember the first pack that you opened?
So the first pack that I opened was an unlimited starter box. And I think I pulled up like a plateau, and at the time everybody was like, oh, these aren't that great. It's like, oh, who wants to play this? Like, what's the point of having these? And then, you know, dual lands nowadays. So.
Well, that's a nice pull, and unlimited is not one that we hear very often. So Ron, great to meet you.
Yeah, it's great to meet you too.
Yeah, Leviathan, as I mentioned, this was like the go-to card everybody wanted from the dark when it came out because there was no card that was a 10-10. It was the biggest card that had been printed. It's 5 blue, 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 blue. That's 9 mana for a 10-10 Leviathan, a rare from the dark. It has trample. It enters the battlefield tapped, but does not untap during your untap step. At the beginning of your upkeep, you can sacrifice 2 islands to untap it, and it can't attack unless you sacrifice 2 islands. Why? Well, as Ron explained, you can use it as a wall, I guess, just a 10-10 wall.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you could cheat to untap it, but even then, as you're not actually attacking with this thing. I love that the Leviathan started off this kind of like trend where they kept making bigger creatures in the game in within a short time period. So you had, you know, Leviathan, and then like the next playground discussion was, what would you have, Polar Kraken or Leviathan? Polar Kraken was bigger, so it was always Polar Kraken. And then finally, Frix and Dreadnought topped it. And so, but that had such a huge drawback that even elementary school kids in 1996 realized that that card was not really good. You'd still want Polar Kraken because you can actually keep the Polar Kraken around versus the Phyrexian Dreadnought.
That's true. So Ron mentioned that he also liked to play an untapper in these decks to untap Leviathan without sacrificing islands. So it became the wall. So I pulled together a couple of options. Chain Stasis, which is a reserved list rare from Homelands. Single blue, you can tap or untap a target creature. Then the creature's controller can pay two in a blue. And if the player does, they may copy this and choose a new target for the copy. So this is like Chain Lightning, but for Stasis. There's also from Ice Age, Infuse, which is two and a blue for an instant, and you can untap an artifact, creature, or land, and then, like a lot of Ice Age cards, you draw a card at the beginning of the next turn's upkeep. There's Jolt from Mirage, which was the same card. And then Twiddle, which was from Alpha, Beta, and Unlimited, which was just a single blue tap or untap of land, artifact, or creature. And I have trivia for you, Christian. Okay. Out of all of the cards that were not printed from Unlimited to Revised, do you know what makes Twiddle unique?
Did they change the type line on it?
They didn't. This is kind of a hard question, so I'll just tell you the answer. They brought it back in fourth edition. This was the only one where they were like, oh, actually, we could have just continued to print this card. So they brought it back in the next kind of reprint collection set. So it could have been that.
I did not realize
that. Yeah, twiddling your Leviathan could have been a thing.
Yeah, Twiddle is one of those cards that has been since the beginning of Magic. I love the original art done by Rob Alexander. Absolutely fantastic. They have updated the art when it was printed in 7th and 8th edition, respectfully, but it just doesn't beat the classic. Like, Twiddle is just a super iconic art for me when I think of early Magic.
Yes, I'm a Twiddle stan. Mm-hmm. I have a few Twiddles from Beta and Unlimited. Twiddle is Modern Legal. It was printed in 8th edition for any of you who want to untap your Lotus Field. This is another way to do it. So
yes, absolutely. Yeah, Twiddle Storm was a thing for a little bit. So that's something.
Yeah. All right, let us get to our next one.
Back at Magic 30 with Sam Beaulieu, we just played in the Halloween Sealed event, which is one pack from each of the Innistrad sets, 7-pack sealed. Sam, how did it go for you?
Honestly, pretty well. Got a surprisingly synergistic zombie deck in blue-black, which was a pretty good time.
Nice. Yeah, it was very synergistic. It was very cool. We are asking people today what your favorite card is from Magic's first year, 93, 94, up through the dark.
So if I had to choose just one card, it would likely be Bizarre Baghdad.
Yes.
Because I am a huge fan of Dredge, and the doors that that card opens in a Dredge deck are absurd. And it's just like one of the most simple yet complex, I guess is the way to describe it, cards in Magic. I think it's hilarious. Like whenever I read the original art text on that card, it's like a paragraph long, but like the revised version and like, I think it was Gatter, they changed it just like draw two, discard three. But like they had to describe it so crazily, but
yeah. Yeah, really interesting one, and definitely a late bloomer. You needed the Dredge cards and the things that cared about your graveyard to make it make sense. In early Magic, it's like, why would I ever play this? It doesn't even tap for mana. What am I doing? Do you remember the first pack you ever opened of Magic cards?
I believe so. So my uncle originally bought me a, I think it was a dual, like one of those intro dual decks from Zendikar. And I remember not the first pack that was in there, because there was a few packs in the back, but it was the Allies deck, which is, of course, like one of the worst ones, like historically. So I was just like, oh, cool, they have all these cool synergies. And then it was only after the fact that I found out that it was like one of the like worst tribes at the time. But it was still cool. I mean, like my first deck that I ended up building from there was a Gruul deck. I really liked the aggro to start out, and it was after that I kind of get to more like complicated interactions with like colors like blue black or Esper, Sultai more recently. So yeah.
Nice. Well, I hope you enjoy the rest of your Magic 30, and thanks for doing an interview.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Bizarre Baghdad. I'm going to read this because it's fantastic. I'm going to read the old text first, and then, Dave, you can do the new text. So the original text was, tap to take two cards from your library, after which you must immediately discard three from your hand to your graveyard. If you don't have three or more cards in your hand, discard your whole hand. No spells may be cast between drawing and discarding cards. So, wild. A lot of text.
Yeah, so now it just says tap, draw two cards, and discard three cards. I feel like I said everything I could say about it in my conversation with Sam, who was very excited to talk about Bizarre.
Thank goodness for Dredge. That's all I got to say. Have you ever used it as a value engine? I've done that a few times. It's pretty wild.
No, I've never played any kind of Dredge anything or just, you know, draw a bunch of cards. I would love to at some point.
You should. You should try Dredge and Vintage. It's up your alley for stupid stuff you can do in Magic.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to our next interview.
Okay, so I'm here with Steve, who is a judge. Are you a level 3?
I'm a level 1 judge.
Oh, that's awesome. Congratulations. That's awesome. Again, we're asking everyone, favorite card from 93-94 and the first booster they opened. So what is your favorite card from 1993 through 1994?
93-94, I'm going to give a two-part answer. Lightning Bolt, obviously, was pretty good. I liked playing red back then. I really liked the Uthden Troll. Hard to kill, that seemed amazing, you know, back in the day. So that was, you know, around, I started playing around Revised and the end of Unlimited. I think the first booster pack I opened was Revised.
Oh.
And I couldn't tell you anything that was in there, but I know that would have been the time that I was playing. So
were you trying to trade Duel Lands for Shivans?
Probably at that stage, you know, I didn't have a whole bunch of cards. Ended up getting a lot more into it. Into Ice Age and Alliances, and so then when I started playing again about 7 years ago after a break from like Homelands until you know, Khan's time or right before Origins, I had a few Force of Will sitting in a box, and so that helped finance the restart.
That's awesome. Well, I'll let you go back to judging. I really appreciate it, Steve. Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Good luck on the podcast. Yep.
Can I read Lightning Bolt? I want to read Lightning Bolt.
Absolutely.
Red, instant, lightning bolt deals 3 damage to any target. Woo! We've talked about this card a lot. It did win the Magic bracket, so we talked about it with David Leifert-Tilly. I believe it was in a signature spellbook. I can't remember if it was Ryan or someone.
Probably Ryan's, yeah. I mean, that's
the appropriate.
Yeah. Let's talk about the more interesting card here, which is not a card that we've discussed ad nauseum. It's Uthden Troll. Uthden Troll is 2 and a red for a 2/2 troll, and you could pay red to regenerate Uthden Troll.
This was a nice card. I was a big fan of Uthden Troll and then a big fan of Sedge Troll, which was another card from early on here. That one, almost an identical card, 2 and a red for a 2/2, but you pay black to regenerate it and it gets +1/+1 as long as you control a swamp. So that was a potential 3-mana 3/3 in alpha, which is just wild to think about.
Absolutely wild. And also, this is where you could play Badlands to play both Sedge Troll and Uthden Troll. You had your troll deck. I just love that poor Gray Ogre automatically obsoleted, right? We have our talking in a Magic Facts show about cards that get obsoleted. Imagine a card that people still refer to as like a bad standard for limited creatures, and it was already obsolete in the first set it was printed. Like, wild.
Yeah. Not one I thought we'd be talking about anytime soon on the podcast. Can I just note as well, I love that it went Gray Ogre, better is common, better version Uthden Troll is uncommon, and then the better version Sedge Troll was rare. That's just a really nice, clean vertical cycle.
It is. It is. And in case, by the way, in case you don't know what Gray Ogre is, it's just 2 and a red for a 2/2.
Yep, that's in the Magic Card Dictionary for a reason.
Okay, speaking of iconic red cards, why don't we go to the next interview?
All right, I am here with Jonah Calvo, who apparently used to go to my LGS. We just played our first round of a Theros Block Sealed event here at Magic 30. Jonah, do you have a particularly memorable card from the first year of Magic?
Yeah, so for me, that would have to be Blood Moon from the Dark. Ever since I've been playing Modern, I've been main decking Blood Moon in most of my decks. It's probably a card I can contribute a majority of my wins to, and I think it's cool how a card created early on is very relevant, very meta-defining in current formats, and does a good job at sort of preventing certain things from happening.
Yeah, I don't know when they printed that in 8th edition if they thought it was going to be a long-term competitive staple, but here we are. Do you remember the first pack of cards you opened?
I do. So we just finished playing some Theros Sealed. I started during Theros, and the first pack of Theros I opened had a Swan Song. Woo. And I remember being baffled at how bad this card was, giving your opponent a 2/2 bird for one mana. And even at the time, I think it was maybe like a dollar or less. And then as I learned about EDH and people playing it competitively, the price crept up and I was like, oh, this is better than I thought. So Swan Song was the first rare and I was very disappointed.
That's nice. Swan Song was kind of a late bloomer, I think. It wasn't really played in Commander very much, and then people realized, yeah, a 2/2 bird for one mana is pretty good. Certainly a pet card of mine. How did you enjoy the first round of Theros Sealed in this crazy format?
It's been good. I started playing during Theros, but I never got to enjoy the Limited because I was scared of drafting, and I'm learning that the cards I grew up with are a lot weaker than I remember them being.
Yeah, we're playing some total garbage in these decks, so thanks for doing an interview with us. Good luck the rest of the weekend.
Thanks. Yeah, no problem.
Gross, and I hate it.
I mean, it's a classic. Blood Moon, man.
It is a classic. I just like to play multicolored decks with bad mana bases. So, never been super interested in Blood Moon.
In case you don't know what Blood Moon is 2 and a red for an enchantment, and it just says all non-basic lands are mountains. That's it.
Why?
All non-basic lands are mountains.
this is just a classic color hoser. It's not as brutal as some of the ones in Alpha, which is probably why it got a reprint in 8th edition and made it modern legal. But no, yeah, for whatever reason. But by the Dark, they had kind of figured it out. And they said, all right, this doesn't punish you if you're playing other basics, which obviously everyone has in their deck, because this was printed at a time where we didn't have Shocklands or any of these other things. We had the original duels, and then we had stuff like Hammerhand and Teleria from Legends, which are just like, I guess that's a mountain now. Not personally a fan of this card, but it could be worse.
It does what it needs to do. Actually, it's really funny, too, because it is one of the best hosers of all time, and yet no one really plays it much in formats where it's legal because it's easy to play around. So we kind of figured out how to play around it. It's still good, but people don't respect it as much anymore.
Thank God. Disrespect.
Well, let's end on a group interview. I got to interview some people waiting to get their card signed by Alana Danner, who is the artist of Jewel Lotus, among other great cards. And here's what they had to say.
We're outside the Artist Alley? I don't know where we're at. This place is kind of confused. Artist Alley? Okay. I'm here with Chad, Mary, Harrison, and Merrick, and we're going to ask everyone their favorite card from 1993, 1994, and the first booster pack you ever opened. So let's start with Chad.
It's definitely a toss-up between Ice Manipulator and Mazavith, because I'm a dirty control player.
Okay, yeah.
And first pack was Ice Age that I remember opening, and I think notably I had both a Hydro and Pyroblast in it, which I thought was cool.
Well, that's really cool. That's awesome. Like, it's got that duality going. Yeah, that's really sweet. Mary, what about you?
Oh, God, I wasn't even playing then. I'm not even sure how to answer that question. Harrison, what do you got?
So my favorite card from that era is Dark Ritual, because the first time I played Magic was with my friend and his dad's cards, and he had a black suicide deck from that era.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
And then it's not a booster pack, but I remember the first Magic product I ever got was the mono red theme deck for Champions of Kamigawa.
Okay.
And I remember thinking that the goblins from Kamigawa looked really cool. Oh, and all the different like Aki, like Avalanche Raiders and stuff like that. Like, I just remember seeing, I had never seen goblins like made like or like designed like that. And I just thought it was, the design was super cool.
That's sweet.
Yeah, those are really, they're like fantastically weird and awesome.
For a dry builder.
Yeah, there we go. Steve, yeah. Wait, do you remember your first product, Mary? By the way, Mary's in a Chandra cosplay, which is fantastic. So got the hair dyed and everything, got it all set up, so.
Honestly, I think it was actually fairly recently. I think it was like Ravnica, to be honest.
Original? Return?
Return.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't even remember what I opened up out of them because I turned around and handed them to my boyfriend and said, now you're going to build me a new deck.
Here, what about you?
I actually wasn't even born then, but I'm sure I have scatters of some cards from then.
Elves.
Yeah, I actually have a lot of Atlantor elves.
Sweet, sweet. And then what was your first booster you ever opened, our first product?
That would be a starter pack I got from my uncle in 2019, I think.
Sweet, that's awesome though. Okay, well thanks y'all, really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thanks so much.
Icy Manipulator, what a classic. 4 generic mana for an artifact, 1 and tap an artifact, creature, or land. This was my first Magic Holy Grail, and I have a beta one now and a couple unlimited ones, and they make me very happy just to look at. It's a beautiful card, and I don't like playing against it. I just did Dominaria Sealed on Arena, and I feel like I played against Icy Manipulator in every match, and it's still very good after all this time, at least in limited.
Yes, it should be good. I wish they'd print it. Like, I'm glad they're printing it more often, but it really is a iconic card. I say that a lot, but really, like, it truly, like, you look at this Douglas Schuller art, it's the orb, just amazing. I mean, it even, yeah, the second art for it even has a nickname called Bone Crank, right? But yeah, I just love it.
The orb on the Icy Manipulator is the art that I use for my Xbox gamer tag logo, because it's a circle, and nobody has yet said, is that an Icy Manipulator? But it sure is.
You're a man of culture, I see.
So I have a quiz for you here.
Yes.
And a quiz for our listeners that people can play along at home. We have not talked about this. I apologize. This is kind of a difficult one. This is one of 6 cards printed in Alpha Beta Unlimited that were removed from Revised that is Modern Legal. Yes. We've already talked about Twiddle.
Yes.
Which was reprinted in 8th edition. Can you name any of the others? Icy Manipulator's first reprint was in Mirrodin. That's what made it Modern Legal. But it's been reprinted a couple of times since.
I have to think real quick. I'm going to guess they're obscure cards. No, they're not, because they get reprinted in Modern.
None of these cards are particularly Modern playable, but these were in Unlimited, not in Revised, and have been reprinted into Modern.
I don't have an earthly idea, to be honest. Like, I'm trying to think of Modern cards in like 8th edition or something. Like, Giant Growth was reprinted in Unlimited and are Revised, I should say. I have no earthly clue.
All right, I will give you the 4.
Yeah.
The card Invisibility was printed in 8th edition. That's blue for an enchantment, and the enchanted creature can't be blocked. There is Dwarven Demolition Team. That's 2 and a red for a 1/1. You can tap to destroy a wall. That was reprinted in 8th edition as well. Reprinted in 9th edition is a classic, Jade Statue.
Oh, yeah.
That is a 4 mana artifact that you can pay 2 and it becomes a 3/6 artifact creature until the end of combat, which you can only do during combat. And finally, one from the Time Spiral Time Shifted sheet, Psionic Blast. 2 and a blue for an instant, deals 4 damage to a creature, a player, and 2 damage to you. So that one was actually reprinted with the original art.
Yeah, that's great art. Wow, I couldn't even, I should have gotten at least Psionic Blast. I'm embarrassed, so. Why don't we talk about Mazavith here? Mazavith, man, these are all good ones. So it's a land from the dark. It's an uncommon. You can tap to untap target attacking creature, prevent all combat damage that's dealt to and dealt by that creature this turn. Pretty self-explanatory. It's been reprinted. It was reprinted in Double Masters and Eternal Masters. So, you know, you got some cool reprints of it that Commander players love to use.
Yeah, super, super sweet. I had a copy of this from the dark back in the day, and when I came back to Magic, it was the one card where it's like, where's my Mazavith? I want to play this card. I don't have it. And then I realized, no, I traded it. I traded it to Mike. Mike still has the same Mazavith. He plays it against me in Commander sometimes. And I'm like, no, that was my Mazavith. I probably got a Scrubland for it or something, so it's fine.
Yeah, I think it worked out.
Probably came out on top.
Just real quick, you can get real tricksy with this. You can untap creatures that have already dealt damage. So it has some neat, cool little interactions where you can do fun stuff with either Reliquary or any other tap creatures. And
we've talked about Reconnaissance on the show before. Another card that lets you untap your creatures after damage. Pretty pretty sweet all around.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Rit. Dark the Ritual. Bit. It's black mana for an instant. Add black, black, black. That's the text now. It's just add black, black, black. Yeah, I mean, look, it casts Hypnotic Spectre on turn one. Most recently, it just helps you cast Shieldred and Legacy, apparently. That's a thing you can do?
Yes, 100%.
So turn two, Shieldred. Turn one, you just, like, swamp, play a Chrome Mox, cast your Ritual Shieldred, and there are plenty of decks where if they don't have a Force of Will, they're like, well, I can't kill a 5 toughness creature. It's like Gurmag Angler that, like, actively kills them instead of just attacking.
Well, they already take two. They take two the turn after it resolves too, which is insane.
Yes. Yep.
So, yeah, it's fantastic. I think Dark Ritual is sneakily one of the best cards ever because it also probably has the longest list of cards influenced and cast with Dark Ritual that were banned because of it. Like Necropotence, Hypnotic Spectre, stupid combo cards. Like, it's actually a pretty extensive list that I can't remember off the top of my head right now because it's a little late. But trust me, there was a long period where people were like, why do they keep banning cards other than Dark Ritual? Dark Ritual's the one causing all of these issues.
And the last one here, Llanowar Elves, classic, the original, green mana for a 1-1 Elf Druid, no longer summon elves, but an Elf Druid. And you tap to add green. It's, you know, we got its twin Elvish Mystic in the Explorer Anthology recently on Arena, because it had a printing in Magic 2015. And it's amazing how this effect is so good, sometimes the deck just wants eight of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you in the playgroup when you started that they thought people thought they could fetch forests with Llanowar Elves?
No, but that was an original incorrect interpretation of this card. People thought that they could tap it and then, you know, you're getting a green mana. So what you do is you go and get a forest from your deck and you put it in play. It's like, no, that's not what happens.
It would have made some of those legends in Legends a lot better. The ones that tap for random, like a black or a blue. That'd be a lot better if those legends could fetch islands or swamps, you know? But
yeah,
not the case.
Not quite the same. So were you surprised to see Llanowar Elves printed into Standard?
No. No. It's good, but they could stand. We could stand to use more Llanowar Elves in our life. So I think it'll be fine. As long as you have some good pressure valves for it, which are ways to kill it quickly in different colors, like, I think it's fine. It's also a really bad card after the first few turns, too. So you kind of have an inherent risk, right?
It's good if you, your opponent has the Abyss. That's just one card to throw away. Well, these were some really fun interviews. I had a great time at Magic 30. And I just wanted to, before we go, have a general Magic 30 discussion. I just want to say, for the record, unsurprisingly, it was not as bad as Twitter made it look like it was. The internet is very negative at times, but no, it was good. As an example, there were a lot of pictures of the empty command zone on the first day, and that was a real thing, but they fixed it. They cut that space in half starting the second day, and so there was a lot more room to play. The outside play spaces were great. I don't know if they were responsible for those or they were just part of the venue. They had an extra space in a building over that was excellent. We could have used a lot more of that. And the entry process was a little challenging.
Yeah, for you it was, because they kept flagging you every day. With your
glasses. That's true. My sunglasses case kept setting off the alarm. But I mean, when we lined up to get in the first day, I know you had some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was worried. Like, the first day was kind of a little bit chaotic. It was one of those things where the event was really crowded, but it didn't feel like it was crazy. I think it's because people started to play more after the first day. So, like, you didn't have as much traffic in, like, the front half of the venue, which was where the stage for the panels was on the left. The World Championship stage was on the right as you were entering. And in the middle was all the artists and the vendors and the free play space. I thought it was fantastic, but I also was going in not expecting to get handed a golden ticket and also open 15 Black Lotuses. So, which is what every Magic player feels like they're entitled to.
Yeah, that's true. We kind of went in expecting that there would be some problems, and there were. I think some of the events had issues. The biggest problem for me was communication. They had these tables in the event areas lined up really well in Wooburg color order. The tables were wrapped from white to green. And actually, the gold section at the end was the command zone. And it wasn't clear in the companion app or in signage where individual events that we were signed up would be. And so when those events were delayed and there wasn't communication, then it was very confusing. So even if an event was 20 minutes late, it was kind of like difficult to figure out where do I need to be.
Right. And everyone was a bit rusty. Judges, the people were handling the software. There's been a handful of large events that have happened since people think these events have restarted, but it's not at the same volume and the same level as they were pre-pandemic. So people were shaking the rust off. I also thought I got to go into the Crimson Vow party for a brief moment on Saturday night. It was kind of an odd fit, in my opinion. Like, you go in and there was a line to go to a buffet, I think, or something, or someone handing out food. It was a cash bar, so I also was turned off by that. And then there was a DJ outside with Edgar Markoff and Olivia Valderin, which were played by Brian Kibler and Olivia Gilbert-Thix. And the DJ was trying to hype the crowd up, but it was like kind of off. And I don't know. It was just a weird fit.
I will say I loved that everyone I talked to, including people like who were visiting people in my event that I was in at the time, who went to the Crimson Vow party and then came back from it, were like, yeah, I don't know. It was kind of weird. It wasn't my scene. DJ was great, though. So whoever the DJ was, everybody just loved this DJ.
DJ was on point, but it was just still weird. Like, Magic players, not a dancing group, unfortunately. It's kind of weird.
I think it is fortunate. I will say the health check was really smooth. I was really impressed with that. It was very quick. Mask usage was really uniform. I got a reminder once, actually. I had been drinking water, and then I just like left my mask down and was talking to somebody, and some person at the event is like, hey, you need to wear masks when you're inside. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize I wasn't. Thanks for that. I didn't see anybody complaining about it or just like walking around with no mask on. And I gotta say, no con crud for me. I came back feeling phenomenal. No cold, yes, like you would normally get at these things.
Masks work? Who knew?
Yeah. Scientists knew.
The one downside to all this is they used a system for determining how comfortable you were talking to people and being close to people. And so it was a three-color system. It was green, yellow, red to mimic a stoplight, right? So green meant it was good. You can go high-five the person, I think is what they said. Yellow was you can say hi, but like no contact or something. And the red was you have to keep 6 feet away. I didn't see anyone with a red bracelet, anecdotally. Nope. And it was crowded enough that like you couldn't really do the orange one very well either. So like it was just annoying. It was hard to get them off. The first night I had to use your nail clipper, remember, to tear it off because it was too tight. Yeah,
it's the kind of bracelet where like if you tighten it a little bit, you can't untighten it. So when you tightened yours, it became a problem.
Yes. Yeah. So there's got to be a better way to do it.
The event floor, I have to say, I was very impressed with. It did not feel like an old Grand Prix in some abandoned suburban Walmart. There were plenty of vendors, not just around the edges of the room. The crowds could be a little oppressive there, and there were really long lines for the artists, but that was mostly a spacing issue. The thing that blew my mind is there were multiple setups that were designed to look like rooms on different planes, like a throne room on Innistrad and like a bar in New Capenna. And they just had these tables in them. We walked in and we were like, what are these? And it's just like, oh, they're free play spaces in these like really cool environments. And these were kind of in the middle of the hall, which also helped separate like the artists and vendors from the play space a little bit. Visually just really phenomenal.
Absolutely. I took pictures of them. I would love to see more stuff like that at future cons. They did a really good job.
I heard a couple of people say that those sections made it feel like a convention and not a magic event, not like a Grand Prix or some just like tournament where everybody went to do side events.
And it was also nice because there's like technically a main event, right? They had like the whole modern feeder tournaments to go to data draft, but it wasn't really advertised at the event. The event was about the event itself. And I think that's a great idea. It was refreshing.
I don't even know where the modern event was happening, because it was not the primary feature of the room, unlike the main event at a Grand Prix or something like that. I thought the panels were great. They had a great space that was just a corner of this giant hall they had set up. And it was actually kind of fun to hear crowds laughing and cheering while you were playing in events. I think this is going to be a staple of future conventions. And they've done some of these things at the previous Magic GP Vegas. So I wouldn't be surprised to see them take them other places. I will say the World Championship was happening, and it's not a lot of players, so it was kind of isolated, but that was in another corner of the event. That space looked great. The backdrop and everything, it was always kind of weirdly smoky in there because of the smoke machines. The only problem was everyone was on a computer, and I hated like looking over and it's like, oh, there's all of these cubicles at the play space. So it's like, you can't really see what the matches are. The finals were cool, but they were still just like on computers playing on Arena. And I guess that's what we do now for these tournaments. But I don't know. That space was neat. It was great to see the desks for coverage and everything set up. And, you know, people would stand around the event area where they had set up some TVs so you could watch what was happening. It was just nice to see that competitive high-level Magic event. Shout out to the champion, Nathan Stewart. Shout out to podcast favorite Greg Orange, who had a winning record. Didn't get all the way, but, you know, I'm Team Citrus all the way.
I watch a little bit of it, too. I don't like watching people play games on cubicles. If I wanted to do that, I would just fly to Korea and go to a LAN
cafe. Yeah, like a LAN center, yeah.
Yeah, a gaming cafe. I'm good, you know. So we really liked it. We thought it went really well. But what would we like to see if they do more of these?
So I have three things, and I'll be curious your comments on these. The first one is surprisingly more space. And we were using this whole giant hall, so I realize it can be hard to add space to that. But I had a couple conversations with Mark Rosewater, and one of the things he told me was that the earliest lesson learned from this was we could have just used more space. That people showed up, and they were all there the whole time, and walking around, and really shopping the vendors. And so more space could be one of the keys.
Full disclosure, my partner Natalie is in the event space, so I'm now familiar with that whole rigmarole. And it just depends on how much Wizards wants to pony up.
The financials are going to be a challenge. And I think that leads into my second thing, which is I think you need to not gate the command zone play space when you're already charging admission at the door. And maybe that makes every ticket cost a little more because you need just extra play space. And for that play space, you have some judges and some table signs for, you know, people who want to play casual or whatever. But just having a big open play space like they did on days 2 and 3 worked a lot better. I get it when you're charging a fee for those things when it was a Grand Prix and anybody could walk in the door. So people just like walk in and play there. But if you already need to pay for a badge,
I could see them trying to do some exclusivity around it, but it turned out like you could do what they were trying to do with the command zone anywhere else on the floor. So it was kind of a big fish flop. It was, I'm trying to find the best words for it. It was really disappointing. That was a major disappointment for me, was like how wild they tried to like push the command zone.
I like the term fish flop. I've never heard that before. I'm going to start working that into my daily vernacular.
Yes, you should.
I think the third one for me is get the software right. I think Companion had some issues, a lot of issues. It told me I was in events I wasn't in. It was giving me like wrong information for a number of things. And I was told by some people involved that some of the third-party software was challenging for tournament administration and was not providing complete player information and so on. And I'm just going to leave it at that. So getting the software right and the vendor relationships right are going to be pretty critical.
My three, I think. One is I really, really disliked the pre-registration for all the side events. We found out the hard way about how to do it. And then when we went to sign up for stuff, a lot of stuff was already sold out. And it was trying to pick and choose of what's left that we liked. Now, we had both had a great time playing the event, so it wasn't an issue. But it was disappointing that, like, if you didn't immediately sign in, like, after you bought your badge, you were shut out from all these cool events. Like, we had a friend who lives near D.C. He bought the badge the day you could sell it and then didn't realize you had to buy all the side event stuff that day. And so, like, almost a month later, tried signing up for stuff and couldn't sign for anything.
Yeah.
And it was hugely disappointing. He wanted to play Vintage. He wanted to play some other stuff, but he could.
I think that stuff just needs to be communicated better. And maybe you don't need the super long pre-registration for things like It's a Vintage Tournament or Legacy or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think in talking to some of the people who are running the show, some of it was about product availability. So we both did the Theros sealed event. And it's like, you need to get everybody 2 packs of Theros, 2 packs of Born of the Gods, and 2 packs of Journey into Nyx. You have to get all that product there. And so they want to know exactly how much they need to bring ahead of time. But the general lack of side events, there were a couple like mystery booster drafts that they were running as side events, but it seemed like there weren't a lot of options to do those things. And when they were full, is just not what people come to expect from these things.
No, it actually would be a nice reward to get a better badge, but I think having the on-site registration, even though that is logistically worse, if there's a way they could do it, they could have kiosks or something where you can go in and just register the day of, it would be better. I mean, granted, you'd probably just have a stampede of people trying to go to the kiosk to sign up for the high demand things, but there has to be a solution.
I think you're right, although I think there is that problem where people would be racing to sign up then, and so you would still have this limitation. I just think you don't need to do the pre-registration when you're talking about constructed events and when you're talking about like limited events of like the current set or the previous couple sets. You know, you should be able to work those things out pretty easily.
Why not just have like unlimited signups for modern? Or
we totally agree with that. Totally agree.
Yeah. Like there's no need to cap those events. That was just them trying to project logistics and it just didn't cap. My second thing is accessibility to the main tournament site. So we were in the closest hotel to the site, I believe.
Yep.
And it was still almost 3/4 mile walk. If they want to do this again, it should be somewhere that is a lot more centrally located or be in a city where that's easy to get to those sites through like a subway, a bus or something.
Even when we were going by foot, the fact that the path between the main area of hotels, which this is downtown Las Vegas, to the Expo Center took you like under these bridges and you're going down and there's just, you know, it's like trash and like relatively unsafe down there was kind of questionable. So the Expo Center itself was great, don't get me wrong. But yeah, the transportation was kind of a challenge.
My last one is an eternal one because I've been to multiple tournaments.
This is not a new complaint.
Yeah, this is not a new complaint. So Pastimes was the one who's running all the tournaments. They're very cheap is the best way to put it. They can sue me if they want, but it is true. The prize wall was lacking. It was understaffed. The event payout was designed to not be very good, which I'm not really in these tournaments to get a good payout, but like I would like to not have to fight through people and get lucky to get one of the last few remaining good quote unquote prizes from the prize wall.
Yeah, I thought that for like 3-0-ing some of these pretty expensive events, I did not get a lot of prize tickets, but that's been a problem at these events for years and in part because, you know, who's running the prize wall?
I've been at places where like Channel Fireball would have singles you could buy with your prize tickets. And they were really good about having interesting prizes, even up until the Sunday of the teardown for the GP or the Magic Fest. Same with Star City Games. It's definitely a Pastimes problem. I know they're not making a lot of money off of this, but like,
yeah,
you just got to sweeten the pot a bit.
So this leads to the greatest question. Future cons. Would you go to another one?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So I would say yes. What about you?
Yeah. I had a great time. It's all about the gathering, right? This is what people say. I loved meeting listeners of the podcast, players from all over. Shout out to David Leifertilli, who, you know, as we mentioned, I had not met in person. Big shout out to Jared from Mox Topper, our favorite Life Total app, who we met and really hit it off with and like came and had dinner with us a couple times. And we just, you know, played some Commander with, like meeting these people who we have been in cyberspace with, but never meet space. That's M-E-A-T, like, because we're made of meat, not spaces where you meet. Yeah, you get it.
Oh, that worked too.
It works both ways. It was phenomenal. And I just came away feeling so good. Even as I was sitting at the airport waiting for my stupid flight home, which sucked. You know, I was just like, man, it was a really good weekend. I was really happy about it.
I think I would only do at most 2 a year. Like, it was an expensive trip. Muddied once at a Magic Fest, so I can't really say much, but like the prospect of getting your money back somehow through entering the event was nil on this one. But that's fine. This is about the gathering. But yeah, I can only do one or two of these a year. If they had these once a quarter or more, there would be ones I skip. The next one's in Philadelphia. That's close to me. So it's something we can meet at together. It's easy for us to get to. But even then, it's like, okay, we have to find still someplace cheap to stay. I mean, I'll have a car. There's a lot more logistics stuff where it's like, it's still expensive, but what am I going to get if I pay for a vacation, right? This is going to be my 5-day vacation. What do I get?
For sure. Yeah, and I'll consider going to Philly. I mean, I could meet you in Philly. I could fly to DC. We could drive up. I mean, there's just like 100 different options. And
train.
Yeah, from anywhere. Just fly into anywhere. I'll fly into Harrisburg. No, I don't need to do that anymore. But yeah, altogether a really positive experience. So if you just saw the stuff on Twitter that was mostly very critical, as Twitter, et cetera, social media tends to be, take it with a grain of salt. I think our group just had a great time.
But you could still rag on the 30th edition cards. Those are heinously awful.
That's right. Well, hopefully you can join us at some future event. and we want to thank you for joining us today. As always, you can find us on our Twitter at our handle at MemoryJarMTG. We would love your feedback. Please tell us what cards you want to remember.
Again, special thanks to Chris Yates for the logo. We greatly appreciate it. You can find Chris on Twitter at @TeamLikeCompany. That's company with a K. And until next time, remember, it's all about the gathering. Have fun with your friends. Meet some people you haven't seen in a while. And most importantly, play a lot of Magic.